Lord of all fullness, Lord of all joy, whose trust never shall light nor cares will destroy, neither ever waking and give us, we pray. Your bliss in our hearts, Lord, at the break of the day. Lord of all eagerness, Lord of all faith, whose strong hands were skilled at the plane and the lathe, neither ever labors and give us, we pray. Your strength in our hearts, Lord, at the noon of the day.
This is intended to be a brief introduction to Celtic Christian spirituality. I'm intending that I will talk for about 40 minutes with welcome interruptions from you, and then that we will talk in discussion mode for about 20 minutes. I am quite aware that I am not an expert on this subject. Some of you may be experts, and I urge you to correct me or add to what I say as we go along. I see my task as introducing the subject to you and then inviting your response. Unfortunately, the bookstore at Holden does not have many, if any, books specifically about Celtic spirituality that I was able to find. There is a little bit about it in my own book, Thirsty for God, which is a history of Christian spirituality from beginning to end. And so it has only a little bit about Celtic spirituality. I am someone who believes that it's important for us to look at the whole Christian tradition as a way of background for considering contemporary spiritual movements. In other words, there are great fads about this and that and the other thing. I think that all of us need some perspective in order to make sense of what's happening immediately. I think that our horizons need to be widened both in terms of time and of space, that most of us need to go beyond our grandparents as what the Christian tradition is, and we need to go beyond North America as considering what Christianity is. I believe that in principle, Christianity is a global faith, not a European one. Though in practice, Europe, for historical reasons, has dominated the Christian world. Those sorts of commitments you will find expressed in Thirsty for God. I'm especially eager to talk about Celtic spirituality with you because last month I spent the whole month in Great Britain, much of it trying to learn more about Celtic spirituality. I had my first, real introduction to Celtic spirituality when I had a chance to spend a week on the island of Iona in Scotland in 1991. I did not go there this time. It's even more remote than Holden, if that's possible. There you have to take two ferries to get in. So you don't go there unless you really have the time and really mean to get there.
There's a program on Iona this evening, too.
Yes, please tell us exactly so those who'd like to come would.
9 o'clock here in the Firestone Room.
Okay.
Julie McCann.
Okay.
Doing
good.
Slides.
So. Okay. Slides of Iona. Okay. I've forgotten about this. Roll the tape. My name is Brad Holt. The title of this session is Celtic Spirituality. It's intended to be a brief introduction to something that could well take us a whole week as most every one of the subjects that we study here is like that too. So having had the chance to visit Ireland for the first time, and Wales for the first time, and England not for the first time this summer, I got a chance to see some things which I'll be showing you in slides, partly of what we saw, and I'll be giving you some background and then some reflection and some questions for discussion after I've presented the information. So let us begin with a bit of history and geography to get a sense of what we mean by Celtic spirituality. In general, just roughly speaking, Celtic spirituality refers to the spirituality of the people who lived in Great Britain from about 500 BC until about the present day. But Christian Celtic spirituality really refers to the 5th century to the 12th century. The Celts are a people who moved, like most did, from west to east across Europe. They seem to have lived on the Danube River for some time. And eventually, about the 5th century BC, they moved into Great Britain. And later, they were conquered by the Romans, but they were the British people known by the Romans. So some people call them today the Romano-British. Many of them became Christian fairly early. We don't have much information about that. When the Romans left around 400, there were many Christians. Eventually, the Saxons and the Angles came in and pushed the Celtic peoples westward. So that today we think of the Celtic peoples as the peoples of Western Scotland, Ireland, the Isle of Man, Wales, Cornwall, and Brittany in France. Those are the places that are particularly noted for Celtic people. There were, yes?
Did the Druids precede the Celts?
The Druids, as I understand it, were Celtic. Stonehenge preceded the Celts. A lot of people have Celtic and Druidic religion connected with Stonehenge, and that may be that it came about, but Stonehenge was built long before the Celtic people were there. There are two branches of languages, the Goidelic, which we have today in the Irish and the Gaelic language of Scotland, and then the Brythonic, which is the branch that you find in Wales, Cornwall, and Brittany. So what we're asking is, what was Christian life like among this group of people between the time that we have information about it until more Roman unified prefabricated patterns left little left, though much did stay underground, and part of our sources that people use about Celtic spirituality are the prayers collected in even in the 1800s in the Outer Hebrides of Scotland, that is the far western islands of Scotland, which were far out from the centers of British culture. So let me look now with you at the map and tell you about some of these things very briefly. We don't have time to go into detail a lot. In Ireland, the sites that are particularly connected with Celtic spirituality are many. Here are some of them. Dublin did not exist at that time. Dublin was invented by the Vikings, some of my ancestors, I guess. South of Dublin in the Wicklow Mountains is Glendalough, which is the center connected with St. Kevin, and you're going to be seeing a lot of pictures of that in a few minutes. Kildare is the center particularly related to Bridget. Kells is known, connected with Columba, and also with the writing of a beautiful manuscript. We'll be talking more about that. Monasterboice is one of the centers of an ancient monastery where there are beautiful carved Celtic crosses. These crosses traditionally combine a Latin cross with a circle. And there's a great deal of discussion about how to interpret that circle. No one knows for sure exactly how it got to be that way, but there are lots of theories as to what that circle might mean. One of the theories is that it comes from Druidic practice. Another theory is that it is the circle of creation, of the world, or of the horizon. There are many different theories about it. The crosses can be found in all of these places I have mentioned as having Celtic background, but most of them are in Ireland. Iona, I mentioned up here in northern Scotland. Now, I'm sorry, I've blown up Ireland much bigger than it would be in relationship to Great Britain. These aren't necessarily what you would find in the National Geographic. We have a lot of Christianity in Great Britain and in Ireland of which we don't have records. Particularly during the Roman times, there's evidence that there were Christians there during the Roman times. When the Romans left, Christianity was much destroyed by the pagan Saxons coming over from Germany and southern Denmark, and they pushed the previous population westward, as I said. But there was a sort of new birth of Christianity in the period that we're going to talk about, and one of the important people there is Patrick, who wasn't Irish himself, but came from Great Britain, either Wales or Western England. His parent and grandparent were Christians, even priests. So you see there was Christianity there before his time. He was taken a slave, lived for 6 years as a slave in Ireland herding sheep, and while he was herding sheep, he had a conversion in which he began to pray. And he says in his confession that he prayed about 100 times a day while watching the sheep eventually. He had a miraculous vision which told him how to escape. And he escaped from slavery, went back home, went down to Gaul for further study, and then came back to Ireland as the most famous first missionary. But remember, he wasn't the first Christian there. There were Christians before Patrick. But he's well known because he founded monasteries, he founded churches all over the island. And so, of course, is the national saint of Ireland. These three, Patrick, Bridget, and Columba, are the Holy Trinity of Ireland. They are the three most famous of the Celtic saints. Bridget, I read to you a little bit about this morning, living there about in the middle. Columba is a person who became a monk Now, these people were not necessarily priests, these many monks and nuns. Let me go back to Bridget for a moment. What I didn't say to you this morning is that she was an abbess of a monastery that had both men and women in it. And that is one of the special characteristics of this kind of informal monasticism of these early centuries, which owes a great deal to the monasticism of Egypt. That's why I list Antony up there. Antony of Egypt is often thought of as the founder of Christian monasticism. No one knows for sure who was first, but he had his life written by St. Athanasius, and that counts a lot for your publicity. Yes?
Was celibacy part of that whole picture yet?
Telepathy.
Celibacy.
Celibacy.
I'm saying it wrong.
Not always. Sometimes, yes. It was not demanded of priests, but it was part of the monastic tradition, yes. Now, one of the things that people like to say about Celtic spirituality is that it owes a great deal to the desert mothers and fathers of Egypt and Syria in the 3rd and 4th centuries, especially the 4th century. They claim that there was a direct connection between this edge of the European world and the Middle East, which was not mediated through Rome or Gaul. I'm a little bit skeptical of that claim. I still have to investigate it more myself, but it's a very interesting idea. Now, the evidence for this is in part that at Monaster Boyce, I have seen it myself, and I've heard it told how Esther Duval, who is one of the best known writers about Celtic spirituality, came to Monaster Boyce, looked at that cross, and said, "What are Antony and Paul of Thebes doing on a cross in Ireland?" And this set her working to answer that question, and her answer was that there was a great deal of influence from the Middle East directly through trading routes over the sea to Ireland. Columba, to get back to Columba, it is said, again, now my best source here, Ed Selner, doesn't repeat the story, but the story is that Columba got in a big copyright dispute with another monk. He copied the other guy's manuscript without permission. And when the case was brought to the king for adjudication, the king said, "The fawn belongs to the doe, the calf belongs to the cow, and therefore you have lost, Columba. You have lost your copy. It wasn't right for you to do that. You have to give it to the original author." Then Columba was very angry, and he, together with some other people, got in a big battle, and he killed some 3,000 people in that battle. Then he later repented of having killed them all and said that he wanted to save as many souls as he had killed. So he became a missionary, and his mission led him northward. It isn't obvious on this map, but it is north, and he went to Iona in 563, if I remember correctly. And it's very... If any of you do have a chance to go to Iona, please take the chance. And do come tonight, and your hunger will be whetted for it. In Iona, Columba and his companions founded a monastery And then he traveled from Iona out into Scotland to the Picts to bring Christianity to them. And he probably did exceed his 3,000 in his lifetime. But beyond his lifetime, another person from Iona, Iden, went around here to Lindisfarne on the invitation of the King of Northumbria. And that island is called Holy Island, and it is again a very important place to stop if you're going to Great Britain. The ruins of a medieval monastery are there, together with memories of Iden and of Cuthbert. And Iden and Cuthbert really are the ones who brought Christianity to the Saxons. One could say, contrary to what many of us have learned in church history, that Augustine, who went to Canterbury, was not the one who brought Christianity to Great Britain at all. He came late. And in fact, it was due to a woman's prayers that he was ever invited. Bertha, who was praying every day in the church of St. Michael, I think it is. Some of you may know better, in Canterbury. It's a little church up on the hill. She was praying there every day for the conversion of the peoples of England. And eventually her husband said, okay, I'll let people come from Rome to do that. And eventually Pope Gregory I, as some of you know very well, the one for whom Gregorian chant is named, sent Augustine, who arrived in Canterbury in 597 and established a cathedral there, which has become rather well known. This is late, the cathedral at Canterbury. Already 100 years earlier, up here at St. Asaph, there was a cathedral. Those who study Celtic spirituality point to the same. What is that?
It's the church.
Oh, okay. It's not the siren.
Saxons.
Saxons. In 664, at the Synod of Whitby, which is located here, roughly, the Celtic leaders gave in to the Latin or the Roman leaders as to two issues that divided them. That is to say, the Christianity that was organized from the southeast clashed with the kind of Christianity that had been here in the west and in the north. There were two issues that were at issue there. One was the date of Easter, and the other was the form of tonsure, that is, how monks should shave their heads. The Latin form was to have a bald spot on the top. I suppose Luther himself had that. And the Celtic kind was to shave the front of the head and have a line from ear to ear and then have long hair after behind that. Well, these may seem to us to be very trivial matters to argue about, but they were important at that time. And they were more important symbolically than they were in themselves. Because what it meant was that this sort of renegade Christianity, sort of renegade, that had been going on in Western Isles, was now gradually brought under the Roman administrative system. I've mentioned now Antony, Patrick, Bridget, and Columba. Let me say a word about these I haven't mentioned, Kevin, Nunn, and David. Kevin was an Irish monk who founded Glendalough, he, like many other people, had a very big tension between wanting solitude and serving a congregation. He went to Glendalough to get away from all the people, and all the people followed him. It's a repeat of Antony's story in the Egyptian desert. Eventually, the place where Kevin went became a big monastic city. The story that is often told about Kevin is that he was up in his monastic cell. I've seen the place. It's about as big as the fireplace here. There's nothing there left because it was all wattle and daub, which is a way of saying dirt and sticks. That's how they built. And it's said that he put his hands out his window in prayer one day, and a blackbird came and laid an egg in his hands. And like other Celtic saints, he was so careful and so appreciative of the other creatures that he didn't dare move his hands. So he held his hands out like that until the egg hatched and the bird flew away. Now, of course, all of these stories are legendary, but they point to things. Nun, for whom we don't know her dates, lived largely in Cornwall and Brittany, but it is said that she gave birth to David at what we know today as St. David's. David is the national saint of Wales. She was raped by a king. She conceived David, and she gave birth in a field, which you will be seeing in a few minutes, it is said. And so great was the miraculous character of that birth that there was great light and thunder and lightning. And while she was giving birth, she reached out to the stones around her and she squeezed the stones so hard that her fingerprints are still in those stones like wax. Now you can't see that stone. That stone is underneath the chapel that has her name. She was a nun, N-U-N, and a missionary from Ireland to these various lands, and God used that terrible way to bring Saint David into the world. And he became a monk and a very strong one. He was about 7 feet tall, and he would go out with the plow instead of using the horse to plow the land. He'd be the plow person. Well, I've said a little bit about all of those. Let me show you my pictures now. Someone, would you turn off the lights off there?
Do you want the screen down?
Oh, and then drop the screen down. Chair out of the way. Ready. How did the Celts live? This is a rebuilt house in an Iron Age fort. That's my wife Linda on the right side. I said, this is the hat for you. As you see, it's a thatched roof and it's quite large. There could be many people living in there. This is inside. They had a little oven there, which impressed me. And this is a building for food storage. You Norwegians, what's the name of that building for storing food? It's like that in the sense that it has, you can't see it on the picture, but it's got separation. You can't get inside and eat the stored food. Oh, I'm so embarrassed I can't think of that word. Anyhow, you find them in Norway. Now this is Glendalough, as you see it today. One of the main characteristics is a tower. You find these all over Ireland. It is said they were built to defend against the Vikings, who of course came and destroyed monasteries and stole things. You see the door down near the bottom. It's actually about 15 feet up, and you pull the ladder up with you. Also at the top, there's a window, and you can ring the bell from up there for the community to hear. This is St. Kevin's Church, or kitchen as it is sometimes called, with the tower in the background. Same thing, all of stone. This is the same church, St. Kevin's Church. You see, it's not very big. And this is the church. There are about seven churches in this on that site, and this one is called the Cathedral. It's a ruin. Notice how the cornerstones are smooth, but all the other stones are rough. This is taken from the east end, looking westward. And if you look through that hole in the wall, you see there's a man in the chancel at the moment. And this is what the chancel looks like. That's the east window. Not a great big window. All of these churches are very modest compared to the ones we saw later in England. And this is Linda's picture of a great tree by another church. One of the things about Celtic spirituality is its connection with nature. And you can't do Celtic spirituality without thinking of the stones and the sea and the trees and the wells, which are the places for Celtic spirituality. And that's how Glendalough is spelled. And this is the last picture from Ireland. Then we took the ferry over to Wales. And now we're at St. David's. And near St. David's is this St. Nun's retreat house and a little chapel built in the 1930s for the retreatants to pray. And this is my beloved in what is called a kissing gate. It keeps the sheep from going in and out, but people can go through without having a stile you have to climb over. And you see that this is right on the coast, the west coast of Wales. It's near the westernmost point. And there are cliffs all along this seaside. This is right next to the previous picture you saw. You'll see it better later. Here is St. Nun's Well. People still come on pilgrimage to this well. You see, she's looking at the sign that you just read. It's very simple, not elaborate, compared to another well we're going to see, Winifred's Well, in a few minutes. Today, St. Nun's Chapel is in the middle of a pasture. And in the church, there is this ancient stone over in the corner there, and that's the beginning of the Celtic crosses. The most simple form is a scratched line with the circle and the cross before they started carving them out. And now looking back, there you see the retreat house. On the left, you find the ruin of the church. And the well is a little bit over to the right from the fenced-in church that you see there. This is right on the cliffs, and it's a very interesting walk. It's called the Pembrokeshire Footpath. It's about 100 miles long. People come out there, you see, she's climbing up the wall.
Where is the path? Is it at the top? Or the
it's
bottom?
At the top.
Mm-hmm. Is there a railing?
No railing. So it is a little scary. So the stones in the sea are the most important things for these Celtic saints. We took a boat out to Anglesey Island. Am I saying that right? Yes. No, Ramsey Island. I get them mixed up. They loved islands, these Celtic saints. They loved to have to be isolated a bit. And this is one that was settled very early on and was noted for its retreat. This is one of the few Celtic crosses in Wales. It dates way back to about 800, and you see the typical Celtic designs on the side of the cross, but it is not a big cross in terms of its cross beam and circle the way some are. Most of the famous ones are in Ireland, and unfortunately I don't have my slides of them to show you. Now we're at St. Winifred's Well in North Wales. St. David's is in South Wales. It's in a town called Holywell. And you see they collected the water from the stream into this sort of swimming pool. And if you get closer, you can walk down. Those are handrails into a place where you can bathe in the water of the well, or you can drink it. And this is a statue of the Virgin inside that enclosure that you see is built much later. And here you see two pilgrims, one carrying another on his back to come to the healing waters. Upstairs there is a chapel devoted to St. Winifred. And you see some of her story in those upper pictures of the window. She was, what shall we say, accosted by a young man who insisted he wanted to marry her. She refused. He took out his sword and cut off her head. The head fell to the ground, and from there a holy well emerged, which you have just seen. Her uncle, Saint, I've forgotten his name, came along, put her head back on, and she was fine, and she lived a long life as a nun after that. If you like magical stories, you love Celtics. Now we're up in a remote valley in Wales, and this church is called Penant Magathlath. I have a hard time because the Welsh don't pronounce their names the same. It again is the place where a woman missionary came from Ireland. And this is the shrine of her remains, which escaped somehow, largely, from the destruction of the 16th century. One of the striking things for me going around England and Wales and Ireland was how the word the Reformation is almost a dirty word over there. It has a different implication than it does for us. And the reason is, in part, that Henry VIII destroyed all the monasteries, the abbeys, stole all their wealth, that led to the destruction of a lot of nice things. And then later in the Civil War, in the 1600s, when the Puritans came around, they destroyed whatever Henry hadn't gotten. So the Reformation in Great Britain was a time of destruction. This kind of shrine consists of three parts. You can't see the bottom part, but you get a little hint over here. There are arches there holding it up, and a suppliant can lie underneath among those arches. The middle part is here with this nice, beautiful fabric on it, and that is the actual coffin of the saint. And then this part up here I don't know that it has a function, but it's artistic. And right here, there will be an icon of her when they get it made properly. This has been fairly recently restored. And in the very back of that church, that is in the very east end, is the place where she founded her first chapel. And again, this is back in about 600 or so. Very early, much older than the Gothic cathedrals that we think of as being so old in Britain and the rest of Europe. And finally, here is a window from the cathedral in Chester. This is a modern window. It's not very old. But it includes many of the Celtic saints. I don't have it very clearly focused, but I can read. I can't read that one. This one is Oswald, Iden, Mary and Joseph, Chad, Winifred, and I can't read that one. And that's the last slide. Would you turn it off for, or turn it down to the fan and let it cool off a little bit? A couple of themes and a couple of questions, and then invite your discussion. Why is Celtic spirituality, among many other kinds of Christian spirituality, of interest to so many people today in North America and in Europe? One answer is that it represents a period of time before the church got all split up. It's before the split of East and West. It's before Reformation and Catholics. People who are longing for Christian unity often look to the Celtic period. Secondly, it is a time when people felt very close to the earth and to the creatures, and so a creation-centered spirituality finds the Celtic period very attractive. However, the Celts themselves were not only creation-centered, but cross-centered. And some of the enthusiasm for the Celtic period is perhaps misplaced or looking at only part of the reality. Because in the Celtic tradition, another important theme is the soul friend, the theme of spiritual direction, we would say today. That is, of having someone who is totally honest and frank with you and who can give you guidance in discerning where you should be going, what is your situation, and who can speak the word of grace to you as well as the word of judgment. The soul friend tradition in Ireland eventuated in the penitential books, which eventually made their way to the continent of Europe. The Irish were not only great scholars, and I haven't mentioned that feature yet, but they were also great missionaries, and they had a lot to do with the conversion of the Germanic peoples to Christianity. They brought with them books called penitentials, which were manuals for hearers of confessions. The Celts are the first people we know of to have private penance and confession. Before this, if you did a bad thing, you'd have to confess it to the whole church and be disciplined by the whole church. The Celtic peoples developed a personal confession and penance, and that eventually came back to Northern Europe in the form of these sort of recipes about what penance would be appropriate for certain sins. We hope that they didn't follow them too slavishly. That is to say, there is a dark side as well as a sunny side to Celtic spirituality. There is a great deal of tears. I remember Esther Duval saying, some people who want spirituality without tears turn to Celtic spirituality. They're mistaken. The tears are very great there. Now, there are a couple of issues that arise from Celtic spirituality. Let me just throw them out as trolling and see if anyone wants to bite or if you have other interests that you'd like to pursue in the minutes that we have left. One is, how do you put together in one spirituality a closeness with creation and a spirituality of the cross? Very relevant question for a place like Holden Village, I think. Another sort of issue is known by the technical term contextualization. It's a concept that arises very much in mission studies today. It is the question, to what degree, in what ways, should Christianity express itself in terms of the culture of the receiving people as opposed to those who bring them the gospel. For example, and this is the one that's closest to me, having lived in Nigeria for almost a decade, what is a genuinely African form of Christianity? At what places does someone who wants to be authentically African and authentically Christian, at what places does that person need to give up something of African tradition in order to be Christian? At what place does Christianity have to bend to fit into African culture when these two things come together? It seems that in Ireland in the Celtic period and in Wales, a great deal of the so-called pagan tradition that came before was adapted, baptized, included within Christianity. At the pagan wells where people came to get water, they were simply identified with a saint and they continued much the same as they had. In sacred groves of trees, they were not cut down, they were simply reconceptualized. All right, let me just stop there. I've been talking more than my allotted 40 minutes. I'm sorry about that. And I just invite now your comments or questions for discussion if I've sparked any interest. You could turn off the fan of the thing now. I think it must be cool.
In terms of what we think of as kind of the revival of some of this, what's happening today among some of the groups, or where is it centered? You're seeing it in relationship to the total Christian spirituality. Is there another tributary or something?
Well, there are different people who are interested in Celtic spirituality today. Some are New Age people. And I hope to talk more about New Age next week, if any of you are still here. I don't know how long you're here. I'll have a session on Christian spirituality and New Age spirituality where we could talk about that. New Age people are particularly interested in pre-Christian Celtic spirituality. Among Christians, Glendalough is definitely a center. Iona is a center. Lindisfarne is a center today of interest in Celtic spirituality. For any of you who live near the Twin Cities in Minnesota, there will be a big conference on Celtic spirituality at the end of November, beginning of December, sponsored by St. K. Kate's, St. Catherine's College, where Ed Stelner teaches. He's the author of the book I read to you from, The Wisdom of the Celtic Saints is his book. And then I have here a little prayers called Threshold of Light, edited by Alchin and Deval. And one of her books, she has three or four on the Celtic, and she's going to be speaking at that conference. It's called The Celtic Vision. And then I have one here by Philip Sheldrake, Living Between Worlds, Place and Journey in Celtic Spirituality. And then there's a new one here called Candle in the Darkness, Celtic Spirituality from Wales. And oh, I did intend to pass these around. The Book of Kells is the beautiful artistic expression of Celtic spirituality, which is found in Dublin in the Trinity College Library. And I can't show it to you. You can buy a copy of it for $18,000. Yes, it's true. It's 680 pages of illustrated manuscript of the Gospels. And they are so elaborate and so beautiful in color that to reproduce them, the Swiss printing company charges $18,000 for an exact photocopy of that book. But since you're with me, you can get one for £3.50. This is the coloring book. And this is a little book telling about how the Book of Kells was made. It was made either in Iona originally and then taken to Kells, or it was written in Kells originally, and it was written about the year 800. And it's just magnificently beautiful and microscopically exact. If you look at this coloring book, it'll have something for you to color. It's this big, and then it says underneath, in the original, this is 7/16 of an inch. And you can't believe how that intricate pattern could be made in 7/16 of an inch.
How would you describe the marks or the of Celtic spirituality? How does it differ from, say, what we think of as our style of worship and cultic and spiritual expression? Are there marks that are so distinctive that
a strong sense of place, a strong sense of the presence of God in everyday life? I didn't have time to read you some of the prayers that come out of this tradition, but they have to do with common everyday activities. So God is very close. Thirdly, the Trinity is very important. And they like to repeat things. So they repeat things three times or five times or eight times. Numbers are important. The tradition of the soul friend, I think, is the most distinctive. Many of the other elements can be found in various other combinations in other types of spirituality. The idea of the white martyrdom, which means traveling as penance. You leave Ireland that you would never want to leave ever for any reason. And you go, you get in your little coracle, which is this little boat with no rudder and no, what do you call that, under the keel. And you just let the waves take you wherever they're going to take you. And you get out and start telling the people about the gospel of Jesus. It's a tradition that glories in miraculous stories, as you've heard a little already, and in very tender poetry. It's a tradition that has valued women more than many others of that period. So part of its popularity today is due to interest in women's spirituality and in ecological spirituality. And part of the danger, of course, is that we remake Celtic spirituality into this beautiful, ideal, perfect thing that existed all that long time ago, instead of being historically realistic, that we can romanticize it very easily. So it's different from, for example, Lutheran spirituality, in the sense that for Lutherans, the main big deal is forgiveness. And surely they were concerned about forgiveness of sin, but not in the same intensity. And the idea of justification was not a metaphor that they were particularly interested in.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the soul friend concept? I mean, how would a person make that kind of connection?
My understanding is that you would either go some distance to find one of these special people who were known for their holiness and who could serve as sort of your spiritual director, or else you would find a mentor who was nearby in your own family or your own village, and you would become soul friends together. And you wouldn't have more than one at a time, but you might have more than one in your lifetime. And the idea is that you talk to them about what's troubling you and your questions about life, and they give you their wisdom looking from outside, looking at you from a different perspective. So this is something that is growing among Lutherans and Protestants and Catholics today in ways that we didn't find even a few decades ago. People are seeking spiritual direction, either from people who are professionally trained or from people who are informally trained.
Is that the term they use, the soul friend?
Mm-hmm.
Or is that,
the term they use is anamkara, which we translate soul friend.
Okay. Interesting.
There is a nun in New York, an Anglican nun, a Benedictine, no, she's not Benedictine, Order of St. Helena, who specializes in helping Americans to understand this. And she has a magazine or a newsletter that's called Anamkara. Mm-hmm. Sister Cintra Pemberton, that's her name, didn't come up right away. Mm-hmm. Sister Cintra Pemberton.
Kenneth Leach, a British theologian, was actually killed here in America last year in a plane crash in Chicago.
No, there's a confusion, because I just talked to that man last month.
Oh, it isn't the same person?
Must not. There's some confusion there.
He was from Birmingham, England. I thought it was the same one. Has written a book called Soul Friend.
Yes. That's the same person, but he didn't die.
Okay. And is he representing the Celtic tradition in that book? Have you read the book?
No, I haven't. I understand that he's more giving a generalized history of soul friendship than writing particularly about Celtic, but I haven't got to his book yet.
I've read it.
Okay.
And he is. It's almost a who's who of spiritual direction, mm-hmm, over the centuries, with little snippets of quotes and a little bit of how people approach it. There's so little that frustrating, actually, because you have to go read more about what these people really said, but a lot of the names are there.
Uh-huh.
But I see some connections here with Lutheranism.
Yes?
The sales sergeant idea of the pastor, the keeper of the soul,
mm-hmm,
the emphasis on the material side of spirituality. And you mentioned the Celts did conversion of the Saxons.
Yes. In the East, in the North particularly.
In the North. Do you know why in the North there was a great emphasis on the material world of creation type spirituality compared to Southern Europe?
I don't know if I would even agree with the generalization, but I know it's too big a question for me.